Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Toonaries podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Toonaries podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friend, Tim Milan.
Hello, everyone.
Our guest today is Darren Wallace from Limerick City Kid. How are you keeping?
Not too bad, no, James, pal.
Great to have you here.
Great to be here, pal. Tim.
How are you, Darren, boy?
I'm all right, bro. Yeah.
Good to have you here, pal.
Yeah. You're a painter, decorator. Amongst other things, you've a lot of education done and you do a bit of volunteering up in Limerick City.
Limerick City Builder, good, that's right.
But you spent a lot of time in prison as well.
I did.
18 years to the day.
Yeah.
For a life sentence.
That's right.
All right, so look, before we get into all that, bring us back to where you're from, where you grew up, what was it like?
Okay, so I come from St. Mavis Park, betterly known as Dowling Field.
Yeah.
Assumpta Park is where I'm from, so it's literally just on the outsides of the island. But family life was it was chaotic most times. It was a lot of instability, a lot of alcohol in the family and what comes with it. So I had a sister, older sister, younger brother and a twin brother. So you can picture the neighbourhood we grew up in. Mm. So the island, it's full of unemployment, poverty, high in education, lots of drinking drugs. Mm. It was drink mainly at the time. So by the time I was 13, 14, I was hitting the drink, I was smoking the joints.
Yeah.
What about primary school, secondary school?
So secondary school, I was gone out of quite quickly. Primary school, I was doing okay into a certain period. And I wasn't going to talk about this now, but yeah, if we're having a conversation,
yeah,
let's have it.
Oh, yeah. This is all in the 80s as well. Yeah. We're talking about poverty. We're talking about a massive recession in the country.
That's right.
Nobody has nothing. The men in Ireland are starting to go to England to get work. And those that stay here are just at home and they're doing what they can. You know, St. Vincent de Paul basically back then really fed the country in many cases.
It would have been lifesavers for a lot of families, that's true. Yeah. But what I was going to go to was, and I think I'll get it out there early, I was in fifth class at the time and I was being a bollocks. So the teacher wanted me out of class, so he sent me into town in the Eastons to get a Marcos. And it was pissing raining on the same day, and I got a lift off a fella, and I was abused sexually on that journey. So I think my whole perspective on life after that, how I was a person, completely changed. You can imagine still to this day has some effects on me, how I live my life. But
so when I was a child like that, you know, trying to form your view of the world, all of a sudden you begin to think like people can't be trusted, adults can't be trusted. Is that kind of how it shaped your view?
Without doubt, and to make it worse, this man was from our community, so everybody knew him.
Yeah.
And it's like still, like this was a secret I kept for a long time. For the best part of 15 years, I kept that longer, I kept it to myself.
So I'm thinking you were 11. You were 11, maybe.
I was 10, just 10, 11. Almost 11, yeah. So I still had to see that man almost every other day after that. But But it's relationships, even with people my own age. It's, you're coming into puberty or girls and things. It was very hard, like, even to form any kind of relationships with people. It was just like my whole trust in everyone was gone. I kind of despised everyone because I thought, like, I wasn't protected. It's like, how can this happen in your community? I couldn't correlate this properly. So, like, my way of showing this was, like, lashing out. It was drinking. It was fighting. As soon as I arrived in secondary school and St. Munchins, it was, I went out here, I feel like an outcast. So I did, like, I fought with everyone, fought with the teachers, and before you know it, I was suspended indefinite. I was, my mother sent me back a few weeks later, saying they can't do that job. I was on the go for 3 or 4 months before she realised he wasn't even at school. So that was kind of the end of my school experience, about a couple of months in Edmund Rice, which was like a joke for school anyway.
Yeah. Did you have much? Were you able to read and write at this stage, Darren?
I could read and write. So I like, in primary school, I learned how to read and write. I wasn't like very...
Yeah. So, do you know, for me, example, do you know, growing up in an area, I grew up in poverty, you know, we didn't have much, you know, it was the 80s as well, and we're going into the early 90s and there's a lot of drugs and stuff, and I'm looking at the lads older than me, do you know, they're involved in criminality, they're involved in drugs and stuff, and I'm watching them, and they have nice clothes, nice jewellery, watches, some of them have cars. Did that ever entice you to get involved in crime at that age?
Without doubt, is it? Yeah. It's impossible not to, I think. And even just the fellas that were even drinking, the other fellas that were drinking, it's like, I want to drink with them. Look, they're your peers. So role models were drug dealers, robbers, thieves, is kind of, yes, the fellas that had the money, they weren't working with people whatsoever. So,
fellas who could look after themselves.
Exactly, yeah. It's that's what I was drawn to, just like yourself, just like James. It's a... and every other community in Limerick, but I guess I'll speak for myself, but I definitely, that's what I was drawn to. Yeah. Both me and my brother, I can't not bring him in because we were twins, so there was two of us. But definitely drawn to that life. Like, it's
and that easy, escalate then at easy a young money. Age.
Yeah, so it's like...
with guards and stuff then coming around the house.
Your GLO, just for simply giving cheek at inside in town, like, you can start simple as that. I think it did for me. It's robbing houses in the middle of the night. It was mugging lads just so I could have a few drinks on the bank. It was the greatest thing in the world. But now you look back and think, I enjoyed none of this. Like, all this was like...
But that was normal behaviour back
then. It was very normal,
For me, would have been normal behaviour because of what I was after growing up. Grew up in an area where it was rough.
What you witnessed?
It was tough, and I was used to violence from the family home anyway, because we three boys, you know, growing up, and my two brothers are probably laughing at me now when they're saying three boys. I was probably the one doing the karate kicks in them inside in the front room, you know. But it was pretty much like that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What was it like in St. Mary's Park around the late 90s, early 90s? There was a lot of issues going on in Limerick at the time. What was it like growing up in around that? Was it tension or like was there an air of insecurity in the community? What was it like?
Well, in the 90s, it was more like it was a drinking culture.
Yeah.
You had your drug culture, of course. It was hash in the 90s, as you know.
Yeah.
Ease, but predominantly it was hash and drink. There was a lot of violence, there was a lot of muggings and all, but there was no real feuding as such at the time. It was more like people were wild.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's we knew you had no chance of getting a job. You had teachers had no interest in primary or secondary, so everyone has left. You were left your own devices. Cops couldn't care what you got up to as long as you were in the island. It was like, we couldn't care, do what you like. So it's...
Yeah.
Okay, we'll resort to, like, what are we left? On a street corner. We'll drink.
We'll get drunk.
We'll fight with people.
Do you know the island? I'm not familiar. Is it actually an island? It's
one way in, one way out.
Oh, is it?
It's surrounded by an embankment, so it's surrounded by a bank and the river going around it. So it's on one end you have King John's Castle, and on the other end you have the church. Which is that St. Mary's Parish, but the island itself is encircled by a bank.
I was kind of wondered.
Do you know when
I won't go down history lane, but like
not a thing.
Yeah.
Do you know when you went into prison for the first time?
Yeah.
Was that for this big sentence, or did you have previous?
I had previous. So
my what age when you went first
in? When I first went in, I just turned 17, and I was in for it was a mugging, and I got 18 months. So it was both myself and my brother. We were both sentenced together for the crime. And I got sentenced to Limerick, ended up in Spike Island within a few weeks for fighting in Limerick. And so that was my first taste of prison life, yeah.
And what age you got out?
So 18 months. I was 18, probably, yeah.
Yeah. Can you talk to us about the events that led up to what you got the life sentence for, without going into the details of the specifics of it or anything like that?
So at the time, so I had literally just been out a few weeks previous to the crime. I'd been drinking heavy, I'd been taking a lot of coke, and I was literally on a mission of attacking people for no reason, basically, whether that be mugging them or just for satisfaction. It was anger and rage inside me, and I drank, took coke, and attack people, and none of which I can take back. That I have to carry with me for the rest of my life. But it resulted in me taking a man's life. But I look back now, when I can see that person, if I could talk to him, I'd say, like, you're going to murder someone. Like, it was that kind of blatant, you know. So
it was just a path to just complete destruction.
Yeah.
What age were you?
I was 20 at the time, yeah.
Did you get caught for it straight away?
Yeah.
Remanded straight away.
Yeah.
So you went in at 20. What's it like for a 20-year-old starting a life sentence? Are you still young and immature and full of with a chip on your shoulder, or are you thinking about the victim and the remorse, or does that come later?
I think regretfully, seriously regretfully, like, I showed no remorse whatsoever. Especially as soon as I entered the prison, I didn't give any thought to the victim whatsoever. I felt more sorry for myself. I hit drugs hard inside there. It was basically like street life within the prison. There was no thoughts of rehabilitation. There was no thoughts of showing my regret for what happened, being sympathetic or empathy. There was none of that. It was just like, fuck you, you have me locked up for life, and I'm going to act out. So, like, I was a 20-year-old man stuck inside in a angry teenager's body, like, really.
When you're that young, you don't really understand what actually you're doing to people when you harm them. It's not till you get older and you get some bit of awareness into life, our own feelings, and after a bit of life experience, you start to understand it. But I'm sitting here down, right, and we're talking about your story, and it's important as well that we speak very openly, and I know you want to be, you know, and the reality of it is someone lost their life, you know, and there's a family out there, you know, and they're missing a family member, you know, and they're probably still hurt. They'll always be hurt, you know, and they're probably watching this now at the moment, and they're looking at you, you're getting on with your life, you know, and they're probably still going to the grave on birthdays and Christmases see this person. You know, which must be very, very tough for them if they are watching this, you know, to see you getting on with your life. What would be the right thing to say to a family if someone was to be given the opportunity to say whatever they needed to say to them? You know, I wouldn't know where to start myself, you know, and listen, I said this to you before we started here. I could be very easily on the other side there, because I was completely chaotic and completely out of control, and I had no concern for my own life or anybody else's life. You know, and I'm very, very blessed and fortunate that I don't have that on me today.
Yeah.
You know, the conscience of taking someone else's life, you know. And since I got in here this evening and I started talking to you, you know, I see somebody that I really don't see how they could take another person's life. You know, because it's not that kind of person. But I can also see 20 years ago somebody that could take another person's life, because I've been a 20-year-old as well, and I know how chaotic can be. You know, like, if you were ever to be given an opportunity to say anything to any that to the person's family, what would you say?
I don't think I have the right to say anything on that,
yeah,
because they might not want to hear it.
Yeah.
Obviously, I regret it. It's like, it'll never leave me, but it'll guide me. And I will live my life until the day I die trying to help other lads, making sure they don't end up in the position I do. Like, I think that's, like, I can, actions rather than words is what I can give. So it's easy for me to say, I apologise, which of course I do. I'll never get over it myself. The fact that I actually took somebody's life, it's like, I still find it hard at times to like to believe that.
Yeah.
But I think actions speak louder than words in this case, and it's what I do with my life is more important. And I think I can respect death to that man by how I live my life, and his family, hopefully, by how I live, rather than any words I could share with you today.
Exactly, because the mistakes you made, I suppose, and the experiences you've had, you use that now, as you said, so that the next young fella doesn't make that mistake. It's like what myself and Timmy do with the podcast. We've done things that we regret, but we can't undo them, unfortunately. But what we can do with those experiences, try to pass on the message to keep, so that the next fella or girl coming up behind us goes in with their eyes wide open.
Yeah.
And there's no medals for doing prison time. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And you get a bit mature and you get a bit older. The old chip in the shoulders is gone.
Yeah.
People are growing up, people are getting out, and you're still there. You know, it's not life, is it?
No, it's not life whatsoever. And I was 4 years into my sentence, and my twin brother died of an overdose. And he'd just come out of treatment centre and looked clean and fresh, strong as yourself there to him. And took a few tablets and heart stopped and died. Like, so I was in prison that time. I didn't get out for, obviously. I got to see him in the hospital. But so that was one eye-opener for me. It's like, really, is this what it's like?
Yeah.
Here's my brother gone. Here's my mother, my father, my sister, my brother are suffering outside there. It's like everybody is suffering because of this nonsense and stupidity. So
Have any advice or words of wisdom for if there's a young fella now starting a life sentence, or he's in the early stages of a life sentence? Is there anything you could say to him to maybe guide him, or I don't know, a bit of advice based off your own experiences?
One bit of advice I would have loved to get, which I didn't, is like, your life sentence starts the day you come in. Like, life sentence prison, especially at a young age, are under the impression it starts after 7 years or 10 years now with the parole board kind of change. It's after my first parole board, I'll settle down. So you have the immaturity in your head that I can drink and take drugs and waste years of my life. But like, don't, like, the minute you come into prison, from that very moment, like,
yeah,
be focused, like, regret with them, because like, no one takes a life, in my opinion, and is satisfied, is happy about it. Like, It's done out of fear, it's done out of anger, it's done through drugs.
Yeah.
Like, it's very few people, I believe, set out to take someone's life. So it's like, they are remorseful inside, really. So it's like, from day one, like, engage with whatever services are there, whatever little services, if it's counselling, probation, any courses that come up, your AVP, Alternative to Violence, your Samaritans or Listeners, which is what it's called within the prison system, your Red Cross, like, engage in their services, get you a bit of education. You can now do your degree inside in prison, which I've done myself, so through the Open University. It's like, focus on getting yourself educated, focus on rehabilitating yourself. No one's going to do the work for you, you have to do it yourself, but do it from day one. Don't wait for 7, 8 years like I did, 8, 9 years, and then say, okay, I've seen so much now, I'll change. Do it from the get-go. It's like, people that are there doing 6 months, 8 months, oh, I want to go in, have fun, take drugs. That's well and good, but you're there for a long time. It's like you don't have to be dislike them. You don't have to keep away from them as in like your enemy. It's just like focus on yourself. Just remember that you have a family outside there who love you, who are going to miss you. You want to go home, you want to live your life, you want to get out as quick as you can. So, like, focus, not go long from day one.
Do you know, during your sentence, when you came in, you hit the head, drugs and stuff really, really hard. When did reality really kick in? Like, after how many years did reality kick in and did you start getting a conscience on, because of your actions and starting to understand what really the reality of what was after happening was going on?
Well, I think after my first parole, which was in around the 7-8 year mark, and when I'm in front of the parole and I saw my dossier, for anyone that doesn't know, a dossier is a report that the prison does on your prison services, probation, everyone, on your behaviour over a 7-year period. I mean, I looked in that and saw all my P19s, child sheets.
Yeah.
And I looked at him and thought,
explain P19 for man.
So P19 is a child sheet, basically.
Within the prison system.
So it's
disciplinary. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So I was caught with a phone. I was fighting with someone. I was caught with drugs. I was given dirty urine, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And I saw the list that I had. And one of the parole officers was reading these out to me. And he's like, what kind of life you're living? Like, it's
yeah.
So it's then is kind of when reality set in. I didn't accept it and completely change or alter myself, but that's when it first dawned on me.
Yeah.
I was still taking drugs at the time, so I couldn't completely focus, but that is when it first dawned on me. But I think it was around like 8, 9, maybe 10 year mark, but I said, okay, look, enough is enough. It's like, I'm sick of this life. I'm sick of the same conversations I'm having in the air every day. I'm sick of going to the gym with the same fellas, doing the same workout. Gym is very important. I'm just saying it's,
yeah.
I needed more.
Yeah.
So that's when I decided to engage with the services and wanting to engage, not engaging to impress a governor or just like to look what I'm doing. It's like I wanted to educate myself. I wanted to rehabilitate myself.
Mm.
So it was around the era 9 year mark, and that's when I started my degree. Yeah. And
Is that lined in as well with kind of men or males where they kind of mature a little bit later? Because I think I wasn't in prison like you for that length of time, but just the cycle of addiction and in and out and stuff like that, and the people that you hurt along the way,
yeah,
never really came into my mind, really.
Yeah.
But now you're around 27, 28, I think, like, the fuck you doing?
Yeah.
You're looking around and you're back at a gaff and you're looking around people that you're with and you're thinking like, what are you doing? Like, do you know? And you're bumping into fellas, they're getting on with their lives, or you're going into prison and the officers are the one age, you know, you're getting on.
Yeah.
You see the 18, 19 year olds coming in and you're cringing, you see the behaviours, because it mirrors what we used to be like.
Exactly.
And you're thinking like, what are you doing? Those fellas are getting old. And you know, I think the maturity is a big role to play as well. You don't really understand consequences until you get to about 26, 27, 28 and you're looking around and you're thinking, what are you doing?
Well, the statistics prove that.
Yeah.
But why is that? Like, that's a question I ask myself through my social sciences studying.
Do you know what my understanding of it is, Darren, is this is right. Men that grow up in environments where they're not able to understand how to regulate themselves emotionally and understand the thinking and understand trauma and understand belief systems that they get when they grow up in areas where there's a lot of poverty and crime and criminality. What happens is when they hit a certain age and they have so much pain from addiction, from mental health, just from prison, hospitalization and stuff like that, it just comes to a standstill and they just hit a place where this voice in the head says, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? And it's when you do stop then, or you go to treatment or whatever, what happens then is the conscience kicks in.
Very true.
It kicks in and all the shit that you've done and all the past and all the stuff from your childhood, if that was buried under layers and layers and layers of different stuff starts to come up to the surface, because you're not using the alcohol and the drugs as the crutch anymore, as this, as the kind of the thing to block off all this stuff. Now you're left with all this stuff here. And if you aren't working with the right people and you have the right services in your life and you're trying to manage this stuff on your own, that can be detrimental to a man's life.
Yeah.
You know, and we all know the consequences of someone trying to deal with this stuff. But I think it's just men in general. In statistic, it's between 30 to 35 men go through that kind of a change in life where it just comes to a standstill and they hit this wall in their life around their heads, and just stuff comes up from, and it's they start working in themselves. You know, that's my reality of it, and I've spoke to a lot of men and I've read up on it as well, and that's how I understood it. But when you're left with all that stuff, you have to find a way out of it, because if you don't, anything at all could happen, you know.
Yeah, but when that realization, that maturity comes,
yeah,
and then you're looking back and you're thinking like the trail of devastation in your past and the years wasted, you know, and then you're starting to think, if you're doing a bit of personal development, you're starting to do a bit of therapy and you're looking at your life experiences and you're starting to join the dots, you know, it can be overwhelming.
Very much so.
You know, it'd be difficult. Yeah. What was it like for yourself at the time, you know, when you're going through this and you're maturing and trying to get your head straight? What kind of supports did you use?
So, for myself, and I took it very slow. I really did. I had a lot to deal with, a lot of trauma, like us all.
Yeah.
So, I think I was mature enough to realise.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I can't deal with everything at once. My mind implodes. Drug counselling is where I went first. So, drugs, what brought me to drugs was kind of, my childhood, what I witnessed, it's kind of, that was my first step. I think then we had a lot of group sessions, and it's AVP was kind of, I got an awful lot out of Alternative to Violence program I was speaking to beforehand, James. And for me, that was a big eye-opener, and it just happened to be that it was a lifer that was actually facilitating that from another prison. They came in doing it with a couple of people from outside. But I was thinking, yeah, I can relate to every single thing here. How I left myself get into that situation is not what I need to deal with. So it was piece by piece. Like yourself, Timmy, I've done years of meditation. I don't do very much anymore.
Yeah.
I don't have the time for it, which is a bad excuse, but kind of truthful. But I've done 2 or 3 years of meditating and yoga. It was kind of like a bit of a lifesaver in between doing my drug counselling. I was still dabbling at times in between, but I got 6-7 month breaks, and kind of, you can work on it. That's time to work on yourself, you know. But it certainly didn't happen overnight. Like.
The Toonaries podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
Yeah.
You know, at the moment, the average life sentence in Ireland is 22 years. What kind of things do you have to do in prison? Or what kind of things would you suggest for people in prison to do to better themselves, to put them in the best position to kind of move away from that life and get parole? Like, what kind of things did you have to do? Or did you do?
So, it's nothing was forced upon me. Like I said, the AVP, you have the Red Cross, outside agencies, mind you. The listeners is a version of the Samaritans within the prison, where you talk to lads who might be suicidal. You'd sit down and have a cup of tea with them.
Were you a listener?
I was a listener, yeah. So you'd sit down, have a cup of tea, you'd have a smoke with them and kind of listen to what they have to say and never talk to them. It's agreement, blah, blah. But so I think you need to do all them. And the reason you need to do all them is because they give you a little bit of education, a little bit of insight. Most importantly, I think, is education.
Yeah.
If you're walking out and you have no qualifications, you're back in the same situation. Probably might look and say, sorry, you're not ready to be released. It's like, you have no qualifications here. You have no job prospects. So, like, why would we release you into society? So I think if you have to start at the basics, you're level 3 FETEC, level 4, level 5, that's exactly what I done. I started my journal cert, done my leaving cert, and then went down and done my degree. So, and
what did you do the degree in?
Social sciences.
Or the Open University?
Through the Open University, yeah.
You know, for people that wouldn't be familiar with prison and stuff like that, what's it like studying for a degree inside? Do you get access to a computer room, or do you get a laptop to bring back to your cell? How does it work?
So it's now evolving. When I started, it was I had to write, handwrite my first two assignments.
Old school.
So old school, right? Then after that, it was in the school, and you'd get a couple of hours where you'd type out your assignment. All of your material for the whole year is given to you in boxes, transcripts. So it's like, you can be, that's not easy. Like, it really is difficult. Like, but it evolved once I got my diploma first, and then I was in Limerick at the time, and I got my laptop. Made a huge difference. But so now, like, it is more complex now for lads to get laptops and access to tutors and
USB sticks and stuff.
USB
like that.
Sticks to send them off, exactly. So it has evolved now. But when I started first, it was really at its infancy, and the prison didn't really know how to go about it themselves. But now it's like,
education really is key, isn't it?
I think. What have, outside of that, within prison, what have you got? Outside, I think, not so much. Even people like my age are a bit younger. I think there's other opportunities out there than education. But within prison, and especially for lifers, long-term prisoners even, it's like, education is the one tool that you have, the one mechanism for you to, like, to rehabilitate yourself, and to give you an opportunity when you get back into society.
And you said it there, like, with the education, it gives you an opportunity to rehabilitate yourself, because a lot of the text around rehabilitation and personal development and personal growth and psychology and psychotherapy, you need to be able to understand these words. You need to understand words around emotions and feelings, and you need to understand how your thoughts are connected to your body, they're connected to memories, and how they can keep going and snowball. And that was the turning point for me, when I started to understand that without the education, I would have never, ever understood all this head stuff, the connection to the head and the body, the emotions, and it was vital for my recovery, you know, just to understand it and be able to pass it on. Education for anybody really inside in prison is important. It doesn't matter what level you are at. I mean, what level you're at.
Or the course.
It's the confidence you get from it.
Yeah.
So for a lad that can't read and write, like he suddenly can read a book, he can start at the very basic writing his name and moving on from there. Like the confidence you get from that, like, and I've seen it, like I was lucky enough, I could read and write. I had the basics, so I wasn't starting from scratch, but other lads like couldn't even write their own names.
Yeah.
And so I was watching them evolve whilst I was evolving, and it's the confidence you get. I remember when I went to a board meeting with the Red Cross. So you had the governors and the chiefs and on side there, and I was my second year into my degree at the time, and I had no fear of it in there. So I remember times going to the governor, I'm like, fuck you, being a dean, and I don't care what I do, what you want me, and but I'm going into a room with these people and I'm looking at them as an equal.
Yeah.
I'm in here to...
Not as an authority figure.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm here to help the prison, to better the prison for everybody. And they treat me with that respect in return. And without education, I wouldn't have that confidence, like being able to sit inside the room with these 15 people who...
Because it allows you to express yourself with words and that, you know?
Vocabulary, it just, like...
But even, when I see fellas in prison that are starting out the education journey, you know, after a while, they go from talking about women and drugs and crime and they get more awareness, and all of a sudden the topics that they talk about are broader. They look at the news with a bit of understanding, you know, and like the more clued in
you avoid the air, you avoid them conversations.
I remember that actually happened to me. Do you know the air thing, chatting about this and that and the other. I used to fucking get this gammy old feeling in here every time we were having a conversation about fighting or fucking robbing or drugs or whatever. And I used to go up to the psychologist and I used to talk about it and say, why am I feeling like this, like, when I'm having a conversation? She's saying, you're changing. Yeah. And what are you getting from it? What's your understanding of the way you're feeling? I shouldn't be involved in these conversations. And they stopped. And when I stopped being in those conversations, I didn't have that feeling anymore. My actual gut was telling me, this is not good for me. Your soul was telling me, this is not.
You were beginning to listen.
Do you know? And that's when things started to change.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And some people don't get it, though.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. But it's there for everybody.
Yeah. It is.
It's there for everybody.
You have to be on the path as well, James. You have to really want it.
But also, it's like, there's a lot of lads... lifers, but not just lifers, across like the board from 6 months up, like they have ADHD, they have mental health issues that aren't addressed within the prison.
Mm.
Prison, they haven't got the capabilities of addressing them. Prison isn't even where it should be.
Mm.
So it's like, how do you help these people? How do they help themselves? Like, they haven't been clinically diagnosed, has been on a spectrum of any mental illness whatsoever, but I can see it. I can tell this definitely is ADHD, can't sit down for two seconds or whatever it may be. So it's there for everybody, but like treatments aren't there for everybody, well, like, for them to actually be able to avail of it. Like,
yeah.
The reality of that is we don't have enough specialists to be able to go into prisons, to be able to diagnose, and people there to be able to help people to cope with this in different ways, you know, cognitive behavior therapy, you know, CBT.
Yeah.
These are great ways, meditation, just understanding it, just informing people around these different things. There's not enough people there, or services there, to be able to help people. Is there, James?
There isn't, like, so for my time in Limerick at the time, you had two counsellors, drug counsellors, and Liffey, and that was for a whole prison system. I think you're talking 300-odd prisoners. That's an impossibility.
Mm.
You had one or two on any given time, probation officers. You had one psychologist. That's for the whole prison.
Mm.
Like, so you have lads who've had reports that have to be done on them for courts. So like these have to be getting preference.
Yeah.
So then there's lads that really need the help who aren't getting it. and they're already backlogged. Like, so like my I've much sympathy for the drug councils and probation and
tough job,
it's an impossible job to do it within the prison system is beyond me.
Two of the prisons myself and Timmy visited, it was complaints rightly so from some of the prisoners around waiting lists for various services and stuff like that. But when we spoke to the governors, every one of them bearing on, they want the exact same things as the lads have, as the lads want. But the big issue was recruitment and staffing, and not enough officers, not enough psychologists, not enough psychotherapists. Like, everybody wants the same thing. But we were at a conference today, I won't name the industry, but huge staffing issues there, staffing issues in the community sector trying to hold. And I think it goes back to the housing crisis, that people can't afford to stay here, they can't afford rent, they can't afford mortgage, and they're just driving in. And it's like we're a wealthy country, we have a lot of money, but the cost of living is so high that it's not actually worth hanging around. And if you wanted to get a job as a psychologist in Cork City, let's say, but you can't afford to rent here, then you can't. So you might love the job, it might be very appealing to you, but it's the other stuff that comes with it doesn't fit with you, you know what I mean? So that was a big problem. But one thing I wanted to ask you was, if you've been in prison for 18 years, what year did you go in?
I went in 2003.
So there was a lot of changes in society since in that time, not least social media, smartphones.
Yeah, I'd never had a phone previous.
Population growth, traffic. What's it like coming out? Do you know, is this what daunting, or are you afraid, or what's it like? First weekend out or whatever.
So when my first time out was going to Patways in Dublin. So
that's a charity. To support people from prison, is it?
No, it's an adult education centre. Okay. But it's run by ex prisoners.
Christy Woods.
Christy Woods, Niall Collins, or Niall
Cat.
Niall, he'll never forgive me for forgetting him. But everyone, the lads up there, they're great lads, but the majority of the lads, the teachers, are ex-prisoners.
Yeah.
But I had a kind of chaperone who was a prisoner as well, came with me on the train up. But very daunting, and it's Dublin City, as you just said, even traffic alone. But it's cash in the pocket, even just like having to pay for something, waiting in the queue, walking into the shop, not knowing even where we're going to find a pack of potatoes, how to interact with people at the counter, how to interact with people on the street, even going to Patwas itself, it's, even though they were ex-prisoners, it was how to interact with them. It's what kind of conversations can you have with people? On first weekend home, and it's, you're home with your family, the people you love and you've missed the most, and it's 18 years, and it's
long.
What have they been talking about for the last 18 years? It's very hard to actually sit down and have a conversation. I done a lot of listening rather than talking, because it's what they were speaking of, I didn't know anything of. I wasn't involved in any of this, so it's it took a while to adjust in that sense. But thankfully I'm a sociable person, so I came around quite quickly. But in the beginning, when they were testing me, daily release and things, it was extremely difficult for the first 4 or 5 weeks. It really was, it wasn't easy.
I was going to an open prison like Shelton Abbey, the best thing for you before that led up to the release to get you prepared for it?
Without doubt. It's a necessity. It really is. It's crucial. Or lock the house either, but it's essential. So went up there and you do an 8-week assessment. When I say assessment, they're watching you. So you do a bit of work in the grounds or whatever your preference is. I chose the grounds. And then they test you going, I want to follow my education route. So I went back on VTech in Patwells, but just to resocialise myself. So they give you that opportunity. They know how they can tell you come back. They know, is this working for me or is it not? Closed prisons aren't prepared for that. They're not set up for that. Whereas open prisons are. You have the freedom of the grounds. There's no one locking your door at night time. These little things are kind of slowly readjusting you to life on the outside and making sure that you're not institutionalised.
Yeah, it's it's a stepping stone really onto this, going out.
It really is, because if
you didn't have that stepping stone and get that little bit of freedom and see a small bit of the outside before you're actually left out, it probably would have kind of came to a just completely exploded for you, because it's a lot to take in when you come out of prison.
Well, you see, lads, and we'll take just short term, for a moment, like the turnaround of lads 6 months, 12 months, and they're back in after a few months, because it's like there's no preparation from going back out. It's they're going back out to the exact same environment and situation that they came from, with no lead up to getting out. So it's like, boom, there you go back in. Like, I could have found myself in the exact same position if I was sent from a closed prison out, because you need to slowly be evolved. Yeah. Like a simple thing, like a prison officer in an open prison with a tracksuit or dressed like ourselves, talking to, hello, how are we getting on, having a conversation as if you're a normal member of society, and he is. You don't look at him as a prison officer. He doesn't look at you on you as a prisoner. It's like, that's massive. Yeah. Some people might say, well, it's not crap, but it really is massive.
That's even part of the process.
100%.
And it's back into
society. Yeah, and it might jump over some people's head, like, but it's simple things like that. Like,
going for a walk on the grounds of the prison, that's another thing.
Changing your time and routine of like 16 and a half hours locked up, changing that routine to your own time.
Yeah.
I can go out until 9 o'clock, walk on the grounds if I want to. Or I can go into bed at 6 o'clock if I want to.
Yeah.
You can go out working all day, which I did up in Dublin, so it was up and down commuting every day. So it's getting into real life schedule rather than the prison routine, which is
When you get out, it's not so much of a culture shock.
Exactly.
You've been leading up to this point. What's life like for you now?
Life is great, to be honest. The best blessed in the world, if I just talk about my 11-month-old son. He's
a big boy, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a big old buck boy. He's he's not taking after his daddy, you know, that's for sure. But I've a lovely, beautiful missus who's there for every second. So the minute I got out, we moved in together. I've been working straight away. I started my master's the minute I got out. Got through my first semester, and through financial reasons, Kay got pregnant, and it was kind of, okay, I have to put that on hold for now. Went working painting and decorating. I volunteer at Limerick City Build with the lads, and it's like, I'm loving life, to be honest, yeah. It's still tough, like, putting bread on the table, and same as everyone else, it's
yeah,
nothing's given to me. Like, I'm working hard. And
what about the reason I'm asking this is because, do you know, when we get out of prison, very hard to be integrated back into society when you have a past, and you knowing then you're not the same person that person was.
Yeah,
and I know it. And you have the guard of Etten. You have all these different things. How are you dealing with all that stuff?
I think
takes time.
Yeah, I put that behind me now. It's at first I was kind of, I remember I wanted to get my passport. And I needed the ML10's form signed. So I had no proof of address, obviously. So I handed in my TR sheet. And when I handed him my TR sheet, he treated me like a criminal straight away, and I felt very belittled. And I came out, I was defeated coming out, and I said, I'm not going to let this happen to me again. Or it's like reality kind of hit home. But so I gave it a few weeks, and I went back in and with my work clothes on, and gave the ML10 form in and signed it straight away. I was polite, not happy.
Yeah.
Thought I was a lovely person, and I thought, okay, look, it's
moving on.
Yeah, and the majority of society, I think, have accepted me. I've, like yourselves, I've done a few talks, I've been on a few panel shows, and whatever. So I think the majority of people have accepted. I think the moment they see you, you're genuine, You know, I think people can tell if you're bollocks or whether you're a legit person that has reformed.
Well, I'll give my honest opinion here on you, and I'm not afraid to give it. From just chatting to you,
yeah.
You know, I think you're a beautiful person. I know shit has happened in your past. I know there's a family there suffering today, Darren.
Yeah.
You know, and there's nothing you can say, I can say, James can say, or anyone can say to bring back that person that they've lost. You know, my heart goes out to him. Mm-hmm. You know, but I do see somebody that wouldn't harm anybody today. I don't know about that man back there. I probably would have been fighting with you if we came across paths, I'd say, back then, because the two of us were just fucking violent
yeah.
and angry people. You know, but I do see a nice person here today.
Appreciate that.
You know, and I wish all the best.
Yeah.
I really do.
And all you can do in the end of the day, like, for people to understand, like, when somebody goes to prison for a life sentence, like, eventually they're going to get out, be it 20 year or 22 year or 25 year, eventually they're going to get out. But what do we want out of that person? We don't want them to re-offend.
No.
And we want them to break the cycle in their own family so that your son won't do what he want. And to go on and make sure that they use their past negative experience to help the next fella. That's all you can do. You can't take back, you can't undo what's done. You can just make sure that going forward that hopefully there's less victims down the line, and that's all you can do.
Well, even with my own son now, like, my father came from a generation of you hide your feelings, which was passed on to me, no fault of his own. It's just like, you hide your feelings, you toughen up, you're a man. Exactly, yeah. Like, that's not how I'm going to rear my child. Like, it's, if you're upset, show it, son.
Express
yourself. Yeah. If you need to cry, you cry, son. Like, and daddy'll give you a hug.
Yeah.
And tell you it's okay. I'll make sure, like, no matter what is going on in his head, that he's safe enough with me and his mother, of course, to tell us. I'll make it my life's goal, like, that he will live life a million miles away from where I lived.
And we're changing the generational stuff.
Exactly.
We're changing lives. You know, where I stopped it in my life, you're going to stop, and so our kids can go on and they can be a part of society and fulfill whatever they're supposed to do in their lives, you know, without getting involved in drugs or whatever it may be. And that's maybe our roles in life here, you know, and it's not a bad role either, is to bring up kids who can really be a big part of society.
Well, if I did so... Where I'm working at the moment, as I said, Limerick City Build, like, you have 13, 14 lads there who turn up every day without fail and to do a bit of block laying, plaster and plumb, the kind of basics. But these lads are turning up every day from the Island Field, like, they're next door to selling crack.
Mm.
They're coming, like, these lads, and I bring them off painting with me, and they might be sending skirting boards and plaster and filling and caulk, and, like, it's... But it's the basics. But it's like, when I see that and I have a chat with these, they're listening. Like, I get that respect off them. I feel I do anyway.
Yeah.
And so it's
a chat.
I can see services out there that are offering the change. Like, and it's I just lucky I got the opportunity to jump on, volunteer, and help on that process. You know.
Well, best of luck with everything going forward. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Brad. It was a pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Absolutely, not a battle. And hopefully we come to Limerick for a live show sometime.
Yeah.
It'd be great.
Yeah.
The boys in Limerick and the ladies, they'll be there. Want to be too happy.
I have to leave the wife at home, like.
You want to cut that out? Do you know what I mean? She fucking boxed the head up.
See you later. I'll see you next week.
The Toonaries podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project,
there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.